jail. And I've been beaten in jail till my body was hard as metal. Until I am free, you are not free either.
Everywhere I go, Lord, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
And I don't mind my light shining. I don't hide that I'm fighting for freedom. Because Christ died to set us free.
I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, I got the light of freedom. I'm gonna let it shine.
Fannie Lou Hamer, born 1917, died 1977. She lived her whole life in Mississippi, specifically Mississippi Delta, the northwest corner of Mississippi. She was born a sharecropper. She died a civil rights hero, an American hero. I think you can call her a Christian hero. I had never heard of Fannie Lou Hamer until earlier this summer when I came across her on a podcast by a guy named Jamar Tisby. And when I heard about her, I started reading book after book after book. And the more I read, the more I learned, and the more I thought I wanted to share that with you, share her life with you this morning, because I think the story of her life can propel us to greater faithfulness to Jesus. For the last 8 years, I think, on Sunday of Labor Day weekend, I've preached what I call a biographical sermon, where we look at someone in history and tell their story to see what we can learn from it and take away to apply to our life. Now, I tell you that to let you know that this is a weird Sunday. It's not how we usually do things here. And if you hate it, don't worry. Just come back next week, and Dave will start to kick off our fall sermon series. But let me set it up with this. There's this thing you see in the Old Testament between the people of God and God himself. And what happens is that the people of God fall into this pattern of believing that their religious rituals will somehow earn them favor with God. And so they say things like, you know, if we put it in our modern context, they might say, "We went to church, God. We prayed, we read our Bible, we served, but you haven't done what we thought you should do. You haven't done what we wanted you to do. You haven't listened to our prayers," which is code for saying you haven't answered our prayers the way we think they should be answered. In the 58th chapter of Isaiah, that same kind of thing is happening. They're recounting all they've done. They're saying, "We even fasted, Lord. But you didn't do what we expected, what we wanted." And God says this back to him in verse 6, Isaiah 58, verse 6. Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke? To set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe them, and to not turn away from those who are your own flesh and blood. See, what God is saying is that every Christian, every genuine Christian, should have a deep social conscience that cares about people who are oppressed, who cares about the poor. See, what God is saying is that if our relationship with him is real, it will result in a concern, a growing concern for the oppressed and the poor. Now, it doesn't come along in everybody's life at the same time. Some people come to it quicker, some slower. And it never looks the same in anyone's life. In other words, if I'm a concern for the poor and the oppressed, it will be manifested in one person's life in a different way usually than the person sitting next to you. But it will come. God is a God who loves justice. And so for that not to be a growing love of our life, for us not to be growing in a love for justice for the oppressed, well, it should cause us to wonder if our relationship with God is as real as we think. So this morning, I want to share the life of Fannie Lou Hamer in three stories. But before we can get to those stories, I need to set the scene for you in which she lived. There are over 4,000 documented lynchings of African Americans that took place in our country between 1877 and the early 1950s, say 1952, which is the beginning or the dawn of what we would call the modern civil rights movement. Over 4,000 documented lynchings. Not killings, but lynchings. Because lynchings are public. Lynchings instill fear. Lynchings intimidate. 255 of those public, intimidating, fear-spreading lynchings took place in the Mississippi Delta, which is where Fannie Lou Hamer lived her whole life. Fact two. Sharecropping was a widespread phenomenon. Now, you've probably heard of a sharecropper, but maybe you're like me and not exactly sure on all the details. So at the end of the Civil War, in 1865, slavery ends. And now people, primarily in the South, have got to figure out what are they going to do to kind of keep their product, their cotton, their farms, their plantations going since their free labor has been removed. And so their answer is sharecropping. And the way sharecropping worked is that a tenant was given a portion of land by the landowner to farm. And in return for that land, they were to pay back about 50%, usually 50% of their crop to the landowner. But there's more to it than that. You see, the landowner is the one who got to determine the crop, who got to determine what scales we would use, often dishonest scales, who got to keep the books. So that when the person who had farmed all the land, who'd done all the back-breaking work in the field, brought their crop in at the end of the year to settle up with the landowner, it turned out that they never made much money. By the way, they had to buy all their animals, all their tools, all their seed, all their fertilizer, everything from the landowner. In fact, oftentimes they weren't paid in cash, but in coupons that could only be redeemed at the landowner's store, where exorbitantly high interest rates were charged. So they never made any money, and therefore they had to borrow money from the landowner to make it through the winter and to buy seed for the next year, which means they were always continually in debt. It was a system they were locked in. You didn't speak out against it, because if you did, you'd find yourself roughed up. You'd find yourself maybe lynched. Who are you going to complain to? Who are you going to protest to? Was sharecropping slavery? No. Was it systemic legal oppression? Yes. That's the world Fannie Lou Hamer lived most of her life, a sharecropper in an era in which 4,000 African Americans were lynched. Story number one, it's August of 1962. It's not that long ago, 5 years before I was born. Fannie Lou Hamer attends a civil rights meeting at Williams Chapel in Ruleville, Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta. There were two civil rights organizations in the Delta that summer trying to register black people to vote. See, the Delta was in the heart of the South. It was the heart of segregation. And so they believed that if they could get black people to register to vote in the Delta, the whole state of Mississippi would take notice. And more than that, maybe the whole country would take notice. And so there that evening in the Williams Chapel was James Bevel preaching. He was one of Dr. King's associate preachers, and he preached a short sermon on Matthew 16. And then he came to a point where he said this. He said, "How can we not recognize that the hour has arrived for black men and women to claim what is rightfully their own, the right to vote?" Bevel's words stirred Mrs. Hamer. She was 44 years old. She'd always been a sharecropper, lived her whole life on the land of a guy named B.D. Marlowe. She was the youngest of 20 children. Her whole family worked out in the fields for Mr. Marlowe. They never made enough money to live on. They were always broke. She remembers the time she started to pick cotton. It was when she was 6 years old. She was standing outside by the road playing when Mr. Marlowe drove by. He asked, "You pick cotton?" She said, "I don't know." And he said, "Oh, I bet you can. And he started listing all the things from the commissary store on his land that he would give her if she picked for him cotton that week. She said she remembers him, Cracker Jacks and sardines, things that he knew that she would love. And so she went out and she picked 30 pounds of cotton. She got what she wanted, but she realized she got more than what she wanted. Because from that point on, she said, she was always in Mr. Marlowe's debt. She said, my parents, they tried to keep us in school, but school for us only went 4 months a year. It wasn't open during cotton picking season. And we didn't have any clothes to wear anyway. So now we're back at that church meeting where James Bevel has issued a call for people to go to register to vote. Fannie Lou Hamer said this. She said, when they asked for those to raise their hand, who'd go down to the courthouse the next day? I raised mine. I raised mine as high as it could. I guess if I'd have had any sense, I'd have been a little scared. But what was the point of being scared? What were they going to do? Kill me? She said they'd been trying to do that to her a little bit at a time for as long as she could remember. She had heard the call of Jesus, a call to sacrifice, but also the call that had a promise of freedom. Now, some historians have tried to say that these civil rights meetings in the churches, that they were more like 12-step programs, kind of social encouragement. But that would be to misunderstand Mrs. Hamer. That would be to misunderstand what actually happened. For all of her work, her life was rooted in her serious devotion to Jesus. So on August 31st, 1962, Fannie Lou Hamer and 18 others board a beat-up bus to go to Indianola, which is the county seat. They were going to go there to register to vote. But when the bus gets there, the reality of what's happening sets in, and nobody gets off. One guy who was there said, we were all too scared to get off, but then this stocky older woman, she got off and she marched right up to the courthouse, went inside, walked into the circuit clerk's office, and said, we're here to register to vote. Everybody had followed Fannie Lou Hamer off that bus and into the clerk's office. The clerk said that everybody had to leave except two people, Mrs. Hamer and a young man named Ernest Davis that remained that could fill out the application. So here's what had to happen. First came the literacy test, and they were given 21 questions they had to answer. Some were as straightforward as what's your name or what's today's date. But if there was anything wrong, a comma misplaced, their registration form would be rejected. But the questions got harder. Who do you work for? Well, you know what's going to happen. If I tell you who I work for, then that my employer is going to know before I get home and I'm going to be out of a job. But just in case, just to make sure, they took all the people who registered to vote and printed their name in the local paper. But it gets harder. Where do you live? See, you know what? The answer to that question is going to be in the Klan's hands before the end of the day. Before you get to work, your employer is going to know. Before you get home, the Klan's going to know where you live. And then if you're bold enough to answer those questions, they hand you a portion of the Mississippi State Constitution and tell you to give a reasonable interpretation. Reasonable according to the circuit clerk's judgment. Mrs. Hamer was handed a section of the Constitution that talked about de facto laws. She said, I didn't even know they had a Constitution until I was 44 years old and showed up in that office. And she said, I know about as much about de facto laws as a horse knows about Christmas Day. But see, that's the whole point, is that none of this had to do with getting questions right. See, this was all about keeping black people from voting. Because white people didn't go through the literacy test. White people weren't forced to interpret the Constitution. Well, all 18 people, they got back on that bus and they headed home. But Mrs. Hamer's day was far from over. Because when she pulled up, her kids came up yelling at her. Mr. Marlowe's been here. Quote, he's blazing mad. Quote, he's raising Cain. And it wasn't long after she'd been home that Mr. Marlowe did show up, and she went out to talk to him. And he said to her, you're going to have to go down and withdraw your name. You're going to have to go do that tomorrow. You're going to have to go down and withdraw your name, or you're going to have to leave here. And she looked at him, A man she'd worked for 18 years, she looked at him and she said, Mr. D, that's what she called him. Mr. D, I didn't go down there and register for you. I went down and registered for myself. He said, well, you've got till tomorrow morning to decide. And when he left, she decided. She picked up her bags, packed up her bags, and she left. Mrs. Hamer said, I've been working for Marlo for 18 years. I had baked cakes and sent them overseas to him during the war. I had nursed his family, cleaned his house, stayed with his kids. I had handled his time book and his payroll, yet he wanted me out. I made up my mind. I was grown and I was tired and I wouldn't go back. Mrs. Hamer went to stay with some friends for a couple of nights until she thought that was too dangerous and she left to go to another place. A couple nights later, the room that she had slept in was sprayed with bullets, 16 bullets. By the end of the year, Mrs. Hamer decided she was going to go try to register again. This time she walked into the courthouse at Indianola and looked at the clerk and said this. She said, now you can't have me fired because I've already been fired. You can't have me moved now because I don't live on a white man's land. She was refused her second registration application, but her third one, she was successful. That same day that she registered to vote, her husband, Pat Hamer, lost his job too. Now both were jobless. She said that winter was a rough winter. Story number two, fast forward just a year. So summer of 1962, she tries to register to vote. She loses her job, she loses her house, she loses everything. Summer of 1963, she's invited now to a meeting in South Carolina with other civil rights workers who could be trained on how to get other people to register to vote. So she's going there to receive training so she can go back to the Delta and register her black friends and family to vote. On the way back from South Carolina to her hometown, they stop in Winona, Mississippi. They're on a Continental Trailways bus. They stop at a bus station. They go in to eat, which is legal according to federal law to be able to eat in the public place of the bus station, but they won't serve her. They call the cops. The cops come. They force them to leave. One of the women on that trip with her, a woman named Annelle Ponder, she went outside as they were forced to leave, and she wrote down the license plate of one of the officer's cars. That sent him off, and he and all the other officers arrested all the people who had gone on that bus trip. Mrs. Hamer, they carried us out to the county jail. It wasn't the city jail, but the county jail, so we could be far enough out. They didn't care how loud we hollered. Wasn't nobody going to hear us? And then the beatings began. First was Annelle Ponder, the woman who'd written down the license plate. Mrs. Hamer couldn't see, but she could hear because it was done in earshot of all the other prisoners. And as they beat her, they insisted that she say yes, sir, to them, but she refused. Instead, she said she asked God to have mercy on them, to forgive them, for they did not know what they were doing. When Annelle Ponder walked by Mrs. Hamer's cell, she said that her eyes, quote, looked like blood, and her mouth was swollen, her clothes were torn. It was horrifying. Next up was June Johnson, a 15-year-old girl who had begged her mom to be allowed to go on this trip to learn how to register voters. She too was beaten. She walked by Mrs. Hamer's cell and she said, she passed my cell and blood was running down her face. But everybody there that night agrees that Mrs. Hamer got the worst of it. See, then next they walked into her cell and they said, get up, fatso. When they found out she was the Fannie Lou Hamer who had been causing such problems in the Delta, well, they thought of every insult they could, but mostly said to her, you're going to wish you were dead before this night's over. So they brought in two black men who were inmates at that jail to carry out their torture. She looked at those black men, Fannie Lou Hamer did, and said, you're going to do this to me? But the officers told those two inmates, you'll do this to her or you know what we'll do to you. And so they had her lay face down on a bed, and then they took what she calls a blackjack. It was about 2 or 3 inches wide of leather. It was filled with something heavy, she said. She wasn't sure if it was lead or rocks or exactly what, but they would beat her across her back. When she tried to put her hands back to protect herself, they beat them until they were purple. They beat her leg that was damaged from polio. They beat her and her screams so frustrated, an officer outside the room, that he came in, she said, and started beating the back of her head. They beat her, like you saw in the quote earlier, until she said her body was as hard as metal. And then they told her to get up, and she cried out that she couldn't, and they kept yelling at her to get up until she did. And she went back to her cell where she nursed her wounds, physical and spiritual. She got time to think, sitting in that jail cell after the beating, about the great paradox of white Christians, church people, self-identified Christians. I mean, we don't know them, but that's what they called themselves, who were part of this system that oppressed and damaged and tortured black people. But one woman, white woman, comes into her jail cell. Now, it turns out that it's the jailer's wife, and offers Mrs. Hamer some cold water. And Mrs. Hamer says, "You must be Christian people." And she said, "Well, yes, I am." She said, the white jailer's wife, she said, "I try to please God. I try to follow Jesus. I go to church. I was baptized." And Mrs. Hamer said, "Well, when you get home, would you do me a favor and look up a couple Bible verses for me?" She said, "Why don't you look up one in Proverbs and one in Acts?" And she told her specifically what verses to look up. Now, the jailer's wife, let's pretend for a second that she went home and opened up her Bible to what Mrs. Hamer told her to. What is it that she saw? Well, one was Proverbs 26:26. "Their malice may be concealed by deception, but their wickedness will be exposed in the assembly." See, what Mrs. Hamer, through this scripture, is doing is saying, God is warning you. God is warning you that you can hide me out here in the county jail and you can deny this ever happened. But eventually, it will come to light. And eventually, it'll be made known, even if only by God himself. And the other was Acts 17:26. "From one man, he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their land." See, Mrs. Hamer told her to go look up Acts 17:26 because it showed what God had already taught all the way back in Genesis at the beginning, that every human being is made in the image of God. Every human being is worthy of dignity, value, respect before God, before us, before the law. Racism is not something new. It's not like that's a modern problem or American problem or a Western problem. Not at all. It's been going on since the beginning. Remember back in Genesis, the flood comes and destroys all but 8 people, and then God repopulates the earth. And in Genesis chapter 10, there's what's called the Table of Nations. It's one of those chapters that you open up and it's just this genealogy. It's the kind of thing that you're prone to skip. Except all those genealogies make a point. And the point of Genesis 10, the Table of Nations, is to say, look, all of you people who are fighting to be best, who are saying that we were first, who are fighting for supremacy, you're all wrong. Every human being comes, like Acts 17 says, from one set of parents. Every human being, like Genesis 1 said, is made in the image of God. Your race, your class, your gender, nothing like that makes you better than someone else. Those are the verses Mrs. Hamer shared with that white jailer who self-identified as a Christian. Mrs. Hamer said she never came back to her cell. She's not sure what happened. Later, Mrs. Hamer was escorted out by the jailer himself. She was going to be leaving the jail, and she looked at him and she said, "Do you people ever think or wonder how you'll feel when the time comes for you to meet God?" And the jailer's response was full of embarrassment. He said, "Who are you talking about?" Mrs. Hamer knew well who she was talking about. She looked at him and said, I hit with the truth, and the truth hurts. Now, Mrs. Hamer, she was kind of an earthy person, someone that didn't mind kind of mixing it up. And so maybe this comment offends you. It doesn't me. But she said, if them crackers in Winona thought they discouraged me from fighting, I guess they found out different. I'm going to stay in Mississippi, and if they shoot me down, I'll be buried here. Later on, she said this. She said, I'm never sure anymore when I leave home whether I'll come back or not. Sometimes it feels like to tell the truth is to run the risk of being killed. But if I fall, I will fall 5 feet 4 inches forward in the fight for freedom. I'm not backing off. In the face of massive white resistance, black people had to come to grips with the reality that just being good Christians wasn't going to be enough. Mrs. Hamer explains how many of what she calls the Negro people, they thought that there was this sense that if they could just stand for Christ, if they could live out their faith, that the white people would empower, would compromise, would come around to seeing things as they really were, that justice would come. But she said if that were true, then Mississippi should be the most godly place in the world, because she said 90% of the Negroes that she knew were in church every Sunday their whole life. See, it was time. It was time where Christian love had to shape real, practical solutions, where it took more than just being a Christian, but it took fighting and pursuing justice. Mrs. Hamer, quote, Christianity is being concerned about others, not spending your money on yourselves while people are starving right around the corner. Continued her quoting, Christ was a revolutionary person. He was out there where it was happening. That's what God's all about. That's where I get my strength. Story number three, fast forward just a year further. So now we're in the summer of 1964, and 1964 is an election year. The Mississippi Democrats would not allow black people to vote to see who got to be a part of the Mississippi delegation that would go to the Democratic Party National Convention, which that year was being held in Atlantic City. So the Mississippi Democratic Party allows only white people to vote. Guess what? Only white people got to be a delegate, and they went to represent the party in Atlantic City. So Mrs. Hamer, along with others, said they were going to come up with a parallel delegation. They had a mixed race delegation, mostly black, but some white people. Mrs. Hamer was the vice chair of it, and they went to Atlantic City, and they said to the Democratic Party, you need to let us be the delegation from Mississippi. Now, I don't want to bore you with how party procedures work, but catch this. There's a credentials committee, and the credentials committee is the one who decides who represents each state, who gets to be seated as the delegates of Mississippi in this case. There's 50 people a part of it. They have to get 11, they don't think they're going to get 25. They have to get 11 votes. If they can get 11 votes, it'll be forced to the floor of the national convention. It'll be forced into public. States will have to go on record about who they support. President Johnson, Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ, he's not going to have that. He's not going to allow this race issue to go to the floor of the convention, because he's afraid that if his convention gets identified with civil rights, that his candidacy will lose the Southern vote. So he's got to squash this. Well, here comes the credentials committee. They're out there and they're having testimony about this question of who's going to represent Mississippi. And they have all these distinguished speakers that come and sit at a table. It's being broadcast by all the networks. It's on national television. Dr. King even comes, and he, with all of his eloquence and power, speaks before the credentials committee on behalf of the Mississippi Freedom Democrats. LBJ, he's not scared of Dr. King. Come and go, it's fine. But then comes out the vice chair. Then comes out Fannie Lou Hamer. She's going to testify, and she sat at that desk in front of the credentials committee on live television, and she told the story about how she was beaten in the Winona jail for trying to get people to register to vote. And LBJ is scared to death. Not scared of Dr. King, but scared to death of Fannie Lou Hamer. Why? Because she's raw, she's powerful, she's been a sharecropper. Remember, she's 5'4", falling forward for justice, and she's not backing down. So LBJ panics, and he calls a press conference, an impromptu, hey, we're going to have a press conference. All the networks think he might be announcing his vice presidential candidate, so they all cut away, to see this LBJ press conference. He just called at the last second to get the cameras off of Fannie Lou Hamer. He comes out and says, well, it's been 9 months since President Kennedy and John Conley, the governor of Texas, were shot. That's it. And he goes back in. A 9-month anniversary. What? Well, the networks realized they'd been had. They'd been tricked. And so they took the Fannie Lou Hamer testimony and they replayed it that night. But LBJ's still got to squash this. What's he going to do? So he sends a delegation to meet with Fannie Lou Hamer and the leaders. Here's who he sends. He sends Walter Mondale, who will not too long in the future be a vice president of the United States. He sends J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director. And he sends Senator Hubert Humphrey, senator from Minnesota, who had cared a lot about civil rights and who desperately wanted to be the vice president under Johnson. That's the delegation he sends to meet with Mrs. Hamer, a woman who's been a sharecropper, a woman who never got out of sixth grade. And so Hubert Humphrey had a track record of being for civil rights, and Mrs. Hamer saw tears in his eyes as they talked, and she said, look, if you want this job so bad, it's going to keep you. It's going to make you sell your soul and keep you from doing all the good things you've said you want to do. But the meeting keeps going, and they keep pressuring them to take a compromise. But remember, Mrs. Hamer is not backing down. And so she looks at Hubert Humphrey, and she says this. This super powerful guy. She says this. She says, Senator Humphrey, I've been praying about you, and I've been thinking about you, and you're a good man, and you know what's right. The trouble is, you're afraid to do what you know is right. She says, you just want this job as vice president. I know a lot of people who lost their jobs, and God will take care of you, Mr. Humphrey, if you lose out on this job. Mr. Humphrey, looking him eyeball to eyeball, she says, Mr. Humphrey, do you mean to tell me that your position, that this position is more important to you than 400,000 black people's lives? Mr. Humphrey, I'm going to pray for you again. She wasn't invited back to any more meetings. Civil Rights Act passed 1964. Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. The first time a black person in the South could be confident that they could go to the polls and vote without harassment and that their vote would count. That was 52 years ago. Mrs. Hamer died of complications from hypertension and breast cancer in 1977. She was 59 years old. She was buried in Ruleville, Mississippi. Her funeral was attended by many, by over 1,500 in just one of the locations in the local high school. Andrew Young, who was a black man and the United Nations ambassador, came to deliver the eulogy. Now, Mrs. Hamer was known in her life for her songs that she sang. When people got discouraged, she would sing. When they were afraid, she would sing. When she lost hope, she would sing. She sang all kinds of gospel songs, but her favorite song was This Little Light of Mine. This Little Light of Mine is how she gave herself and the other people she lived with courage in the midst of fear. And so Andrew Young, when he finished the eulogy, he led all the people in attendance in that song. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. She was buried at this place in Ruleville, Mississippi. This is her gravestone here. And I don't know how well you can see it, but it's one of the quotes that she is famous for. I am sick and tired of being sick and tired. So what can we learn? What can we take from this and apply to our life? We don't have long, so we're going to go quick. How about this one? Let's start here. This is not that long ago. We kind of have this idea, once upon a time, the United States had this race problem. But man, that's a long time ago. We're not anymore. Huh? 52 years ago? Many of you sitting in this room were alive during this time. I said already a few years before I was born, for sure your parents were alive and remember it well. This is not some long ago time in the history books. What about this one? Why do we think racism is going to pass away? Like I heard after the Charlottesville episode a few weeks ago, I heard people all over the news going, it's 2017, you would think we'd be on this. It's 2017. What are we still struggling with these same issues of the Klan marching in Charlottesville? Now, that's how the secular mind works. The secular mind, the mind apart from God, thinks of something like white supremacy or the sin of racism as something that will just fade away over time. It's like, well, it's 2017. Why do you ride a horse and buggy? Or it's 2017. Why are you listening to cassette tapes? You know, it's like the progress should just keep marching on and we'll get better and better. Like medicine's better. Everything's better now, right? But that's how the secular mind thinks. It's not how the Christian mind thinks. Because the Christian mind knows that the racism and white supremacy are sins of the heart. So we never say, it's 2017. Shouldn't pride have been gone? It's 2017. How can we still have anger around here? It's 2017. Why is gossip still an issue? We should be past that. We don't say that. Why? Because we recognize that those are sins of the heart, and so is white supremacy, and so is racism. And so with sins, they don't just fade away as time goes by. No, sins have to be repented of. They have to be confessed, repented, turned away from, fought over. We must be killing sin or sin will be killing us. Okay, got to keep going. Systemic racism. There were lots of good people, Christian or not, who were not racist in the South or the North or anywhere. But don't you see, it's the system that was set up against them. There was systemic structural racism, so that even if individuals were not in and of themselves participating in it or supporting in it, the system was still oppressing. And therefore, sometimes Christians have to get involved in fighting the system to bring justice. I know you're thinking, because I've heard it, I've said it myself. Well, but laws can't change hearts. Well, right. We hope every heart is changed. That is a goal. And laws cannot change hearts. But I love what Dr. King said when they said that to him. He said, yes, laws may not make a man love me, but they can keep him from lynching me. And that's a start. We're going to have to fight for justice. It is not a social issue. Justice is not a social issue. It is a gospel issue. Justice is not a Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal, libertarian, progressive. It is not a political issue. But see, what happens is we let it become one because our culture wants to make everything about politics, and we let God's justice become a political issue, and then we say, oh, the church can't talk about that because that's politics. No, 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 no. You don't get to decide what the church can and can't talk about. The church will talk about all the things that God cares about, and God cares about justice. God cares about justice for the oppressed and for the poor. He cares about a lot of things, and we're going to speak to it, not as Republicans, not as Democrats, not as conservatives, liberals, but as Christians. It is not a political issue. We will not let that happen. God used a very ordinary person, a woman who was born a sharecropper, a woman who was never out of the sixth grade. He used a person, a very ordinary person, because the most powerful person in the world is the person who has yielded to God. What might God want to do through you, your ordinary life, your ordinary circumstances to bring justice? Are you yielded to him? Music team's coming back. And so we'll end our time together this morning with where I think all this ends eventually anyway. Revelation chapter 7 says this, after this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. See, this is how it ends. It ends with people of all colors, people of all races, people of all backgrounds, people of all nationalities and languages, arm in arm, hand in hand, worshiping a common Savior. By grace, saved from our sin, worshiping our Lord. So if that's where it ends, if that is heaven, then how come we can't bring a little bit of heaven here? How come we can't fast forward and bring a little bit of thy kingdom come, thy will be done, so that God's will is done, not just in heaven, but even as Jesus prayed here on earth, in our church, in our community, in our lives? Can't we show the world that our light will shine, that what we have in common in Jesus is far greater than anything that can divide us? Amen.